Good evening. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum of the Commonwealth Club of America. And I'm happy to introduce to you tonight speaker Mark Susno, the author of Dancing on the River. And I'd also like to welcome our radio and online audiences. And let me tell you a little bit about Mark. First, he's the author of this book, Dancing on the River, which is available afterwards. And Mark is a life coach, speaker, and author who has encountered many of the difficult challenges that we all have to face sometime in our lives. Inspired by the new millennium, he gave up an exciting and successful career as a trial attorney, in which he was covered by the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and Rolling Stone, to become a life coach. Since then, he has inspired thousands to believe in themselves and to see that what's possible in their lives is greater than they can imagine. He is the author of Dancing on the River, Navigating Life Changes, inspired by his own near-death experience, and is co-author with Zig Ziglar and Brian Tracy in 101 Great Ways to Improve Your Life. He'll talk with us today about the 8 principles of navigating change, and for those of you who have already read the book, you'll know that Mark's near-death experience on a whitewater rafting will never be used as an advertisement for whitewater rafting trips. Mark.
God bless you, sir. Thank you, George, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club, and thank you to you for coming out tonight and being here. And I know that a lot of you had other things you could be doing, and I want to just thank you again for being here and giving me an opportunity to talk to you about something that is one of life's great mysteries, and that's how things change. When you think about it, the divorce rate is high, friendships change, and the average person might have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 careers. And the other thing that happens is that we have physiological changes in the aging process. So life changes, and our job really is to figure out a strategy so that we can learn to flow with these changes and develop life skills that go along with our career skills. And I had an experience that reminded me about how quickly life changes when you least expect it. We've all had experiences that have happened in our life when it knocked us for a loop and we never really recovered. And if we did, we still have those wounds. And other times there's experiences that we have and they have a dramatic impact on us later in life, in a very positive way. And unless we really take time out to really look at our life and to really see how it impacted us in a positive way, we'll never really discover some of our real jewels that really guide us on our life journey. And let me tell you about an experience I had. First of all, I grew up here. I grew up in San Francisco. And I never, unlike a lot of kids today, I never had actually left California until my Uncle Sam, who used to take me fishing after my father died. We used to go every weekend around the bay. And one summer, he invited me on a rafting trip to Colorado. And this was going to be my first time to actually be on a plane. And I remember how I got on that plane, and I had a lot of anxiety about getting on the plane. And when we landed in Boise, I felt, wow, I'm on ground again. And I feel okay. And then I looked in the distance. We started to walk toward a hangar. And I looked in the distance, and I saw this little 6-seat plane. And I looked at it, and I'm thinking, why are we going here? And I thought we would stop, and we'd go in a different direction, but we didn't. We kept walking toward that little plane. And we looked, and there was a little stepladder, and we climbed up, and I'm on this plane, and the next thing I know, we landed near the river, and we got in this old bus, and it started going down toward the river, and all of a sudden, the bus stopped. There was this bridge, this rickety old bridge, and so all of a sudden, they said, we have to get out now. So we got out of the bridge, we got out of the bus went along the bridge, and then we walked behind the bus. So we made it to the river, that night, we had instructions about safety precautions and about things to do and not to do, and it was explained to us that with each day on the river that the rapids would become more challenging. And so that morning I woke up, I was excited, and my uncle said to me, if you want to go ahead and just play around and swim in the river alongside the boat, you can do that. And being that I was a teenager and I was curious, I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I got out of the boat and I started swimming alongside the boat. And it was exciting. Here's this boat and here's me and going along this river. And then all of a sudden I noticed that the distance between myself and the boat was starting to expand. And then there were some yells, and there were these yells like, get back in the boat! Get back in the boat! And I knew that I had to get back on the boat. So I saw where I was, and I saw where the boat was, and I figured if I swam in an angle, I could get ahead of the boat. And that's what I started to do. I swam in an angle, and I started to catch up to the boat. But the boat always stayed ahead of me. And then there was this moment in time when I knew that I couldn't get back on the boat. And that moment in time was when there were more yells. And the yells were, stay in the center! Stay in the center! And that's what I tried to do. I tried to stay in the center as the current swept me. And I swirled around trying to keep my head up, trying to keep my feet in front of me. And the next thing I know, it was over. The boat was through the rapids, and I was through the rapids. And I relaxed. And I thought to myself, wow, I'm okay, I'm not bruised, I'm alive, and everything's okay, until I looked ahead and I saw the boat was still ahead of me. So at that moment, I thought to myself, oh my God, I can't go through this again. And at that same instant, my uncle extended an oar. And I reached for the oar, I grabbed the oar, and I was pulled onto the boat just as the boat went through the rapids again. And the trip continued for another hour that day, and we pulled over and made camp for the night. And this journey continued for the rest of the week. And later, on the way home, my uncle said to me something that I'll always remember. He said, this is the kind of experience, the kind of trip that you're going to think about later in life. And I didn't really think about it at all until many, many years later when I was on a return trip to Colorado. And I visited a friend, and I sat there on his ranch. And I was just thinking. And I sat there on a mountaintop, and I looked into the distance, and I saw this valley, this canyon, and I thought, and I saw a river in the canyon, and I thought about my trip many, many years ago, and all that had happened since I was 13 until that moment where I was when I returned to Colorado, and I thought about the changes that I experienced, the transitions that I experienced, the joys, the triumphs, the disappointments, the heartaches, and all that I've done. I became a lawyer, became a trial lawyer. I tried many cases in San Francisco. I raised a family. We lived in Hawaii for a while. I played music. And I just thought about all these things in my life, all these passages, all these phases. And I realized that there are eight principles that have guided me in my journey, eight principles of change, a transition that have guided me. And I realized that if I really looked at what those eight changes were and understood them more, that this would really guide me on my journey from that point in time. And that's what I'm here tonight, is really to tell you what these eight principles are. And I thought about when I was a young lawyer, and I was going to court almost every single day. And in those days, you didn't necessarily think about stress. You just did it. You were in the action. You just went from all day long, and you were doing it. You didn't have time to wonder if you were stressful or not, especially when you argued to a jury and the jury was deliberating about whether your client's going to go to jail or not. and his life would be changed. And you sat there in the hallway waiting for that call, and all this uncertainty that was going on, and this was going on every day, and then at the end of the day, I was so wound up that I'd come home and I'd have a drink. And at the time, I also realized that in high school, and since I've been a little kid, since I've been 7 years old, I played music. My mother encouraged me to play music after my father died, and I played almost every day. And in college and law school, I didn't play. But once I became a lawyer, I started to play again. And I took guitar lessons. And there was a man named Jan Tangen, who was my guitar teacher, and he encouraged me to meditate. And at that time, I wasn't open to meditation because I was thinking, well, I liked my life. Things were going good, and what value would repeating a phrase over and over again, what value would that have in my life? So I wasn't open to it. And then one day, my life fell apart. My first wife decided that she didn't want to be married anymore. My business partner decided that he didn't want to be partners with me, and one of our workers died unexpectedly. And my whole life was upside down. And the next day, the next time I had a guitar lesson with Jan, I said to Jan, I said, you know what? Tell me more about meditation. And so I began to meditate. And what I noticed was that in a very short time, I had less anxiety. I could sleep better. And I started to have a perspective that I never had before, so I could see clearly what was important. And my values started to change. And what I realized was that center, I found that center that I saw on the river, that I experienced on the river, that center of ourselves where we can see clearly. Because when we're wrapped up in all the emotions in our life and in the world, we can't see clearly. We don't have perspective. And so for the first time, I had perspective. I could see clearly. I could make decisions. And I started to be able to read people better. I could start to sense what people thought before they were going to say it. And so I began meditating. And as I continued to meditate, I realized there was more and more going on here. And I started to read books about meditation. And so when I think about the eight principles of the river, the first one is to live from your center, and that's what I experienced from meditation. And I began meditating in December of 1971. It's almost 40 years later, and I still meditate every day. And that's really how I start my day with meditation. And I have developed what I call a morning program. So I wake up, I meditate, and after I meditate, I start to focus on what I'm grateful for. And the second principle is I'm reminded of, so if you think of the story on the river, you will remember these eight principles. So when my uncle extended that oar to me, I was grateful for that oar. I was grateful for being on that river. I was grateful for the Sierra Club. And you think today of all the good that the Sierra Club has done. And they're still doing it. And they've done it for many, many years. And so I started to realize how important gratitude was. Not only to think about that I'm healthy, to be grateful for my health, for the love of my life, for my family, for the abundance of my life, but I started to look at other ways that I could use gratitude. And I started to realize that what gratitude really does is shifts your focus from what isn't working to what is working. So instead of thinking about what's wrong about your life, what you're disappointed about, you start to think about what you like about your life, what you love about your life, what's working. And I started to realize that we could take this concept, because what we know is that what we focus on expands. Let me give you an example. I used to always have a Volvo. And one my Volvo stopped working, and I said, you know what? I'm sick of these cars. I'm going to get something different. So I looked around and I saw, we went to the different dealers and I got in the cars and I found something that was really comfortable. And it was a little TXX Acura. And I never even noticed what those cars looked like. I bought this car and the next day I started to notice all these other Acuras on the road. And every day now I see, oh, that's a TSX. Oh, that's a TL. And I started to notice all these things that I never noticed before, because what you start to focus on expands. So if you have a concept about who you are, so let me give you an example, is that let's say that some of you might think you're a little too serious. Does anybody think about that? So more than one, I bet. So instead of thinking about you're too serious, with your gratitude practice, after you meditate, you can start to think about to be grateful for your ability to be playful. Because at a certain level, you are playful. And as you start to notice when you're playful, you start to realize that you start to notice other situations you're playful, and that starts to expand. And another way you can do this is another thing that comes up in the work that I do as a coach is a lot of people I work with say, you know, I'm a procrastinator. How can I get out of that? And so what I suggest to them is to be grateful for your discipline. Because if you have discipline, you're not going to be a procrastinator. And that's what I encourage them to do, is focus on your discipline. And just with about anything going on here, you can reframe it and take the opposite and to express gratitude for that. And you start to notice, for example, after I was a lawyer, I started on the work that I did as a coach. And I started going to meetings. I started to meet different types of people, people that I ordinarily didn't meet when I was a lawyer. And I started to notice that, you know, I like to connect with people. I like to really meet people. I really enjoy people. And I started to express gratitude for my ability to connect with others. And when you think about that, you go, wow, you start to think of yourself. You're starting to almost, you're changing your belief system. Say, wow, I really can connect with people. I really like people. And you start to notice other situations that you're starting to connect with people. You start to go to a party and you start to notice, wow, I can really connect with people. I can have a good time. Which leads me into the third principle. And I do this in the morning. The morning program, you start your day with meditation, gratitude, and the third part of it is curiosity. And the way that I think about curiosity is that I ask myself a question. And that question is, I wonder what the highlight of my day might be. And I think about it. I start to think about my day, what I have to do, what already is on my schedule. And then I also think about maybe it's something that isn't on my schedule, maybe something unexpected. So I'm thinking in the morning that my highlight of my day is going to be something I haven't even thought about right now. And so I go through the day thinking about what I have to do, and I'm always wondering. I wonder what the highlight of my day is going to be. And so I know what the events are, but I'm always open to that possibility that it's going to be something else. So by the end of the day, my biggest decision is what was most special about that day. And maybe I'll have two or three choices, which is a lot better than thinking about what can go wrong. The starting your day, which we do a lot, especially when I was a lawyer, you had to anticipate what could go wrong. You had to anticipate every contingency, and we're programmed that way. We start to worry. There are all these headlines, these 24/7 headlines. We worry. That's what we are. We're good at worrying. But when we start to wonder about our highlight of our day, we don't worry as much, and we start to look forward to it. We start to have an expectation that we're going to have a good time. And so really, in a way, it's an empowering question in the sense that it kind of suggests the outcome that you want. So let me give you an example. Is sometimes you might be invited to a party, and you might think to yourself, I don't know if I want to go here. I don't know who I'm going to meet. I went to their party last year, and I didn't have a very good time. And there are lots of things like that where we think about whether we want to do something. And so I started to think about it in a different way, and I started to think to myself, you know, I wonder who I'm going to have the best connection with at this party. I wonder what new friends I'm going to make. I always just wonder, ask myself that question. I wonder what the highlight's going to be. I wonder who's going to be there. And I start to enjoy that because I know now, because I've done this enough, that I'm going to have a good time because I'm looking to have a good time. And what I mean by a good time, what I really value is that connection that we make with others. And when we're open and we're looking for that, rather than what can go wrong or why we don't want to be there, and we're open to making that special connection, we totally change how we think about what we want to do. And we can do this with just about anything, with any experience we have. Let's just take on our day. Back to this highlight, it might be when you're getting gas. There might be an interaction you have with somebody when you're getting gas that just touches your heart. It might be going to the bank. It might be shopping. And when you think about people have name tags, and to say, wow, Shelley, thanks for helping me. And to start to notice their names. People love to have their names repeated. And you think about it, why do they have these name tags? Because they want to be acknowledged. So you start to do that. You start to acknowledge people, and you start to change your experience of your whole day. So you realize there's not this dead time to where you're just going through the motions. So you stay awake, you stay alert, and you start to have that expectation that your life can be much more exciting. So the title of my book, which George mentioned, is Dancing on the River. And sometimes when you write a book, your tendency is to write an introduction, then you write one chapter, you write the next chapter, and finally you finish. But most people that are editors say, you know, don't worry about the introduction. Write your book and then work on the introduction later. And that's what I did. I wrote the introduction, but I knew it wasn't very good and I'd have to rewrite it. After I wrote the book, I rewrote my introduction, and I realized I had to really become clear to what dancing on the river is. And what I realized is, and George would appreciate this because this is, in a sense, a philosophy forum, is that what dancing on the river is an attitude, it's a philosophy about how you look at life. And it's a reflection of a life decision that you make to be happy in the moment, that you make over and over again. And that's what happiness is. It is a choice. And when we start our day with these principles, then we find it helps prepare us for our day. It helps prepare us for life. And what a lot of people don't realize is when they hear this story about me in the river and thinking, oh, my God, you had this uncle that takes you all the way from San Francisco into Colorado and the river there. What kind of uncle is that? And what people don't realize is I had a life preserver on. And I was prepared to experience more fully what life had to offer. And so when you prepare yourself, you're more apt to put yourself out there, especially when you have the certain fundamentals. But part of the preparation is to really start to discover what your values are and what's really important to you. And a lot of your values change as you go through life. So we have to really look at what are these values. And when you think about it, when you think about who you are today that has come here to the Commonwealth Club, all the experiences you've had, all the people you have met in some way have contributed to you being here tonight. And so we look at what are these values that have helped define us. And I started to think about this when I was on that mountaintop, and I realized that there's certain experiences we have, and I started to look at some of my experiences that have helped define who I am. And I call these experiences defining moments. And the first one I had, and these were all when I was in my 20s, was that when I went to college, I started to smoke cigarettes. And I didn't like myself when I smoked a cigarette. And I started to smoke cigarettes. And then when I graduated college, I still smoked cigarettes. Then when I went to law school, I still smoked cigarettes. And I go, Mark, stop this. And I kept doing it. And so finally I decided that I would set up a challenge for myself. And what I said was that I'm going to stop smoking the night before I took the bar exam. That was my challenge. And I said, if I can do that, then I can do anything. I will have tremendous personal power to really create what I want. And so the first defining moment that I talk about in the book is that choice that I made. And my last cigarette was that night before I took the bar. And it turned out that you don't get your bar results for 3 months. So for that 3 months, I was on pins and needles, whether or not I passed. I took all the money that I had, and I went to Europe. And a lot of people those time did. We were, well, you know, we can't get a job now. So I went ahead, I went to Europe, and figured, well, when I come back, you know, I've passed the bar, and I'll get a job. Simple. And got back a week before we were supposed to get our results, and it turned out that I failed. And thought about the cigarette and said, no, I don't want to go back there. And I had to wait another 3 months to take the exam again, and then another 3 months after that to find out if I passed the second time. And fortunately, I did pass the second time. But that was a defining moment, that decision to stop smoking. And it really set it up. So when I made the decision to meditate, which is a second defining moment, I already had developed that discipline to follow through on an idea and to let go of something I didn't want to do. And when you think about it, sometimes we have bad habits that just run our lives. It might be a diet that isn't healthy. And so I went ahead. The second defining moment, as I said, was the meditation. And I've already, you know, discussed previously how important that is in my life. And then there was one more defining moment. And that was when I was a young lawyer, and it was month to month. And I had one client that was a very high-end client, and he was referred to me by one of the most prestigious firms in the city. And I was representing him, and I had planned to go on a trip with my girlfriend. We already planned everything. We were going to go to Greece and go to the different Greek islands. And this was going to be my first vacation since I studied for the bar the first time, and after 2 years as a lawyer, trying a lot of cases, and this guy wanted me to postpone my plans. And so I thought about it, and I had mixed feelings. He told me that if I didn't change his case to make it come sooner, and actually it was really to his advantage that we postponed it, but he wanted it to be resolved sooner, and I could understand his thinking. But what happened was I told him I wasn't going to do that. And he said, well, if you don't do that, I'm going to get another lawyer. And I said, well, you know, you have to do what you have to do. And I went on that trip, and I realized that that particular trip, this would be my only opportunity to go on this trip. So I went. I went on the trip, and I came back. He got another lawyer, and there are three new clients waiting for me. And what that defining moment was, it showed me the value of having a life independent of our profession, because when we have a career, so much of who we are, how we see ourselves to other people and how people see us is really defined by what we do, and people identify us by what we do. I mean, when I would tell people I was a lawyer, they had a whole story about what that meant, that I was a lawyer. Or say you're a psychiatrist, people would have a whole story about the way you think as a psychiatrist, or it could be a minister or a whatever. But people identify us by, oh yeah, if you're this, therefore you should be thinking like this. And so the third defining moment, so what it does, it helps prepare you for what's next in life, because you have more clarity about what's important to you and what you really want to do. And that changes. But what happens is that when you start to get more clarity about what your values are, you have to really start to reclaim your life. Because what happens is very few of us know how to say no. But what happens is we're always saying no in some way. If we're saying yes to working late, we're saying no to what really matters to us. I had a friend who was a brilliant social worker. And the agency wanted to fly her all over. And she just had an incredible way with people. And all she wanted to do was be with her family. And so she said no to the career advancement. She said no to working late, because she knew what she really wanted to do. And she said yes to what she wanted. So learning to say no, we don't want to disappoint somebody. So learning to say no is so important for us to start to really look at what's important to us. What are our dreams? How many of us have dreams that we've given up on? Think about it. How many dreams have you really given up on? Things you wanted to do. You say, well, you know, it would have happened by now. It was going to happen. It would have happened by now. We have reasons why we don't do things. We have excuses. And so when we start to really look at what our values are, and we start to create more balance in our life, create an ability to have better boundaries and to say no, then we start looking at what is it that I really want to do. And so we all live in a comfort zone. We pick friends that we feel that will like us. We're quite often afraid to put ourselves out there. So we're careful. We measure things. A lot of us have been in careers that don't fulfill us, but we're afraid to step out and to see what else is out there. We're in relationships that don't fulfill us because we have this comfort zone as to what we think is possible. So we're in this comfort zone, and we start to think, why are we in this comfort zone? What is it that keeps us in this comfort zone? And we all have these limiting beliefs. And the limiting beliefs usually have, there are two words in the limiting beliefs, most all of them that I can think of. And one of the words, it's either or both, is not. Not as I'm not good enough. I don't have enough experience. And don't is another one that's in a lot of these. I don't think I can do this. We have these beliefs that limit what we think is possible in our life. And we have to step out of that box. So for me, my law career was my comfort zone. I knew the kind of cases that I could do that I was comfortable with. And I was afraid to step out and take on different types of cases because I was good at what I did. And so that comfort zone stayed with me. The boat was comfortable in that boat. But I got out. I wanted to explore. I got out of that comfort zone. I wanted to see what the river had in store for me. And I got out of that boat, and we start to look at these limiting beliefs, and we start to challenge them. And we start to realize, well, wait a minute. That isn't true. That isn't true. Or I'm too old to fall in love. I remember my mother when she was in her 60s, and she met this man, and she fell in love. And I know Annie's grandmother, when she was in her 70s, fell in love. And it's just not too late. And again, it's that not thing. It's too late, or to really start to look, what is it that we really want? What's really important to us? What is something that's on our back burner that we've just forgotten about? What is that dream that we stopped dreaming about? And so we dare to get out of that comfort zone, but there's something else holding us back. And that's that we have resistance. Our the sixth principle is we have to learn to let go of resistance. Because what we do is that we resist being present, and we just resistance shows up all the time. For example, I bet if I asked you a question that half the room would have resistance to this question. And I'm going to ask you that. How many of you have resistance to exercising? Pretty good. Actually, better than I thought. So it's that idea. We have resistance to exercising. And I remember one time when we were in Hawaii one summer, and my son came home from the gym, and he had a quote. And it was one of those quotes that doesn't say who it's from. And it was called The Workout. And as I share this quote with you, think about in your life, think about the workout as a metaphor. A workout is 25% perspiration and 75% determination. Stated another way, it's one part physical and three parts self-discipline. A workout makes you better today than you were yesterday. It strengthens the body, relaxes the mind, and soothes and toughens the spirit. It prepares you to meet life challenges. A workout is a form of rebirth. You not only feel better, you feel better about yourself. It's powerful. It also is a trigger. We have an extraordinary force within us, and when we're into mental and physical fitness, it releases that power, that force. It's that discipline. How do we develop discipline? And it's so important to really develop discipline. Even though we have resistance to doing something, everybody has resistance, but we do it anyway. And I know I've been meditating now for close to 40 years, and I still have resistance in the morning. There's some mornings I wake up, I don't feel like doing it, and I'm thinking, well, there's something else I want to do, or I want to know about, I want to turn on my computer. And yet I don't. I meditate. And I realize it's that discipline really leads to freedom. And when you think about it, when you think about going to a dance performance and you notice the freedom that the dancers have, they move effortlessly. And why is that? Because it's their discipline of months and years of discipline of doing the same thing over and over again. As a musician, you meet other musicians, and all of a sudden you play, and there's magic, and people come up to you, and they go, well, God, you guys sound great. How long have you been playing together? You go, well, we just met. And it's because we have the same commitment to discipline to practice the scales. And practicing the scales leads to that freedom so that we can effortlessly be in any situation musically. So the discipline leads to freedom. And even though we have resistance, we go beyond that resistance. We do it anyway. We do it anyway. It's interesting is that years ago, I was at a leadership retreat. And a lot of the leadership retreats, they have what's called team building. And they have these events, these experiences where you might be on a cable that's tied from one tree to the next, and you walk across that cable. Well, naturally, you're going to fall, but you're harnessed in, so you really can't get injured, yet that fear comes up. And there is one young man that didn't want to do it. He said, I'm not going to do it. And yet he paid all the money to be at that retreat. And he also promised to follow instructions because they said, if you don't follow instructions, it can be dangerous. And so later that evening, he did it. And he was excited about doing it. Later that evening, he shared his experience. And what I realized is that I had fear. But it was better that I had the fear than the fear having me. And when the fear has you, you don't do anything. And when you think about an acronym I like to use for fear, F-E-A-R, is false evidence appearing real. Because that's all it is. It's really, when you think about it, about fear, it's really your imagination. Isn't fear, you imagine the worst case scenario? And part of the reason you do is we all have what I call a VOJ, our voice of judgment. And it's that voice that says, who do you think you are? Well, you can't do that. And that voice, whatever we do, we hear it all the time. It never stops. But we can diminish it a little bit. And that voice is the VOJ, the voice of judgment. There's another voice going on. And that other voice I call our VIP, our voice of inspiration and praise. It says, yes, you can. You can do that. And that voice that encourages you, say, good job. You really handle that well. So often you're with somebody, or I've experienced this anyway, when I'm with somebody and I go, I can't believe I said that. And what did you think you were doing? And that voice goes on all the time. And of course, the other person, he didn't really think anything was wrong. We're so hard on ourselves. We're so hard on ourselves. I remember when I was a lawyer, there was a workshop I did with a group in San Francisco called the Actors Institute. And the participants was someone like myself, trial lawyer. They're comedians, they were musicians, they were politicians. And the last half day, we gave a 10-minute performance. And after the performance, we wrote a written critique of our performance. And each participant also wrote a written critique of your performance. And this went on the whole afternoon. And what everybody noticed was that their critique of their own performance was much more severe, much harsher than the rest of the group's. And the instructor said one thing that I'll never forget. And that was, if you had to hire yourself, you'd never get a job. And that's true. We're so hard on ourselves. And we have to learn to be gentle with ourselves, to put ourselves out there, to get out of our comfort zone, to let go of our resistance, and try something new. Be willing to change. And some changes we react to. A lot of changes in life we react to. The economy changes, we react to that. And but what about changes that we ourselves were proactive with? And when I made the career change from giving up my law career, I really thought about it. I thought, you know, I know there's something else I want to do, and I don't know what that is. And if I don't take the risk right now, I never will. And it was a new millennium. And there was a certain energy around the new millennium, and I was willing to take that chance to get out of my comfort zone and to explore what that was. And I've never looked back. But the thing that I realize is that with all these changes, we can't do it alone. We have to be willing to be connected, which is the seventh principle. And when I was on that river, I realized that my uncle took me on that trip. The Sierra Club sponsored it. And we have to work together. We have to be willing to work together and realize that to make a better world, we have to take all our best ideas and really think about it. How can I make a difference? And so when we really think about putting ourselves out there, and we don't really know how we make a difference. And so what I realize is that what we all want is that we want to be connected. We want to be connected with each other. Everybody longs for to be connected, but sometimes we don't know how to do that. And it's a lot easier than you think, because if you really learn to listen, to really listen to what's going on in the other person, there was an experience I had when I was on a plane, and all I wanted to do, I had a book that I wanted to read, and I'm reading my book, I'm halfway through it, and the person next to me wanted to start a conversation, but I didn't want to start that conversation. And he kept looking. And you know how you're on the plane and you know somebody wants to talk to you and you don't want to talk to them? And that's the way I was. And so he'd look over and I'd maybe quickly look back and I'd get back to my book, kind of give him the idea that I'm not interested. And then it turned out that he said something to me that just triggered the conversation. And we talked. And we talked and we talked. And our plane landed. And I was where I needed to be. He had a connecting flight. And he walked over to the next terminal, sat there waiting for his connecting flight, and I walked with him. And we talked and we talked. And I realized that he was a kindred spirit. He was a kindred soul. And it was fantastic to connect with him in that way. And I realized that, yes, we had that longing to really to be understood, to be heard. And it was because we listened. We valued what we had to say. And so often in the workplace, what people really want is to know they're valued. They don't necessarily want a raise. I think the statistics that I read is that what most people want is to be valued, to be appreciated, not necessarily a raise. And so I listened. And then I realized that we have to also be willing to make that first phone call. How often do you meet somebody and it's really good to see them? He said, God, it's really good to see you. Let's get together. And you're sitting at home or whatever you're doing. You're waiting for that email or that phone call or the text, thinking that, hey, he's going to set it up or she's going to set it up. But what happens is it's not set up, because they're waiting for you to make that first call and you're waiting for them. So you have to be willing to make that first call. You have to take responsibility for the quality of the communication. You have to take responsibility for it happening. And it's easy to do that by making that first call. And the other thing, when you really think about communication and connection, is that it's an art. Communication, connection, which is so important, it's an art and a process, like everything else. You have to practice. You have to do it. And the more you do it, the better you get. The better listener you become, and you start to have this ability to where you really can connect with others. And that's really when we come down to the seventh principle. We're prepared, we're willing to explore, and now we look at the last principle, the eighth principle, and it's embracing the great mystery. Even though we kind of think we have a little plan here, and I think we do, but life still is a mystery. We have plans, and it doesn't quite work out the way that we thought it would. And what do we do? What do we do? How do we deal with that? How do we deal with that great mystery? And so I've looked at that. So often you're disappointed. You thought something was important, and you find out it isn't. And I started to think about that there's this invisible web that really connects more than we realize. It brings us together. with people that are like kindred souls. I think of this concept of gathering our tribe of kindred souls. We reach out, we connect with somebody, and we realize, wow, we have something in common. We have the same spirit. We care about the same thing. We have the same longings. And that's what we do. We reach out. We find out that there is this web. We have the same values. We want to be loved. We want to love and be loved. And we start to reach out. There's this energy that's connecting us all. And I think the time when I really embraced this great mystery was one New Year's Day. It had been raining in Marin for 3 straight weeks. And the sun started to clear, and these friends had told us that the salmon were running in Salmon Taylor Park. And for some reason, I knew that I wanted to go out there and see that. And so I got up, and I after about 10 minutes, all of a sudden the sun came out. It hadn't been out for 3 weeks, and there was the most incredible rainbow. And as I drove over the hill out into the valley, I came to where my friend told me the salmon were spawning. And I saw a guy by his truck, and I stopped, and I stopped my car, and it was raining, and I said, "Do you know where the salmon are spawning?" And he went like that, over there. And I looked, and I walked from where I was, and I walked down toward that creek. And I saw these incredible reddish salmon spawning in about 18 inches of water. And I thought about how miraculous that was. The salmon that are born at that spot, this was 10 miles from the ocean, we're going to make it to the river. We're going to be in an estuary where they got acclimated to the salt water. And then they were going to go in the ocean for a few years, make it back to that same estuary, and the ones that survived make it up to the stream. So I realized there was something else going on, and that was a mystery. And so when you think about there's a mystery, there's also the mystery is in terms of us to really discover what it is that we really want to do. What is it we really want to do? What are we here for? And there's this incredible quote by Mark Twain, who's one of my favorite philosophers. 20 years from now, you'll be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by the things you did. So throw off the bowline, sail away from the safe harbor, and catch the trade winds in your sail. Dream, explore, discover. So what is it that you dream about that you put on hold? What are you going to explore about that dream? And what is that dream? What are you going to explore? What are you going to discover? And there's something that I want to leave you with that Samuel Coleridge said it in the best way. And what he said was that, what if you went to sleep? And what if when you went to sleep, you dreamed? And what if when you dreamed that you went to heaven? And there plucked a strange and beautiful flower. And what if when you awoke, you had the flower in your hand? What then? What then? You have the flower in your hand. Enjoy it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark, for that great talk. I'd like to remind our radio audiences that we're listening to Mark Susno, the author of Dancing on the River. And it's time for questions. And I thought I'd lead off with one. If I would consolidate a lot of your principles, the basic idea is that we have our personalities and we each have our own personalities. And you think that we ought to shift those personalities in a way towards, you know, some other principles of how to do, some other attitudes towards living. And it seems to me that the big persuasive point is, how do you get someone to shift, and why would you want to actually shift somebody else's personality away from what it is that they have, since their own personality is their own work of art. And regardless of what we say about our personalities and whether we complain to ourselves, like you say, or whether we admire ourselves or whether we don't do both, like everybody does, we like our personalities just the way they are. And the resistance, I think, you're talking about, the compromises, the going with the flow, everything really has to do with your own personality and what it is that you're comfortable with, what you like to do, and what you're willing to take on.
Yeah.
So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Good.
About the personality issue.
Well, I look at it this way. We do have personalities, but I think our personalities are always evolving. And that's what we do. It's the river, there's a natural flow to the river. We're always evolving, we're always changing, we're always growing. And we're going to do that until we die. And that's what we're here really to really get in tune with what our really true nature is. And I think as we go through life, I think what's possible is our capacity. As we struggle, there's a lot of struggle in life. And struggle is part of life when you think about childbirth. The struggle of childbirth, yet every mother, there's this, when the baby comes out, there's this incredible miracle that every mother experiences, and all of us do. And what it is, as we start to experience that struggle in life, our capacity for greater joy keeps expanding. And it's my belief that what we're doing really is we're more open. And you don't have to change, but as you're more open to good, and you start to allow more good into your life, life becomes more fun, it becomes more exciting. So you start to experience life as an exciting adventure of discovery, of possibility, rather than something that you avoid. And you're more open, life can be more exciting, and I think that what happens is, yes, you have your personality, but it's going to change, because you're always changing. You have to change, because that's really the nature of rivers. And I think the thing we need to do is to make life more exciting, is to learn to be willing to swim in the deeper waters and the swifter currents.
Well, speaking of a group that, you know, swims in deep waters, sharks seem to have stuck with the same personality and the same desires for 300 million years without any change. I find that a very fascinating cockroaches as well. If you talk about evolution and the change, mm-hmm. I mean, those groups seem to have really got satisfied with what they have. But I think one thing about your message that's very interesting is that the pace of change obviously is increasing in the last couple of centuries. And I think what that means is that more and more individual minds, individual personalities, are embracing change and not being so afraid of it, not being so conservative. And even some are enthusiastic about it rather than just, you can drag me along, it's kind of fun some of the time,
yeah,
but actually enjoy it. I think that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, it's not just technological. There's a reason why the technology keeps changing. It's our minds, our human minds.
Yeah.
That culture keeps shifting and shifting at a faster rate because we look for something new.
Yeah.
So who would like to ask the first question from the audience? Anybody ready for a question? Or shall I? Good.
Hi. Enjoyed your talk very much.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the meditation part of it. Can you get into a little more detail? What exactly do you meditate on?
Okay.
I mean, is this something specific, or is it sort of?
Well, let me just address that briefly, because this is a talk that, you know, George knows, is that I could go on for, you know, I've been, you know, many retreats, weekends, but let me just say it in a concise way, is the way I meditate. I can either meditate on my breathing, on my breath, and or on a mantra, which is a Sanskrit word. And so it's a focus. So I'm always coming back. So what happens is, let's say I'm focusing on my breath. Thoughts come in. They interfere. I'm focusing on my breath or the mantra, but thoughts come in. I think about what I have to do afterwards. And thoughts come in all the time to distract us. And it's the nature of the mind to distract us. And so what happens is you go back to that focus, that you start to have better concentration. You start to have less stress because you're better able to focus on what you want, because we get distracted so easily. So meditation really teaches us about the nature of the mind. But there are many techniques. I don't think it really matters so much. I know George and I have talked about this, but there are many techniques about how to meditate. I think what's most important is that you do meditate. You set aside the time, and you say every morning for 10 minutes or 20 minutes, I'm going to meditate and develop this morning program with the gratitude and the highlight of the day. But I'd be glad to talk to you to the exact details to how you can do that. And what I recommend for people that I work with in my coaching practice is they start just with 5 minutes, and they use a timer, and I might give them an article to read about meditation. I've written an article that about meditation, and there's a whole section in my book on meditation.
I think one of the great ironies of meditation and our interest in it, and also the history of meditation and the history of the experiences of the yogis and all the people that have gotten totally into it, that's very interesting, is that, you know, we're just paying attention to our own minds. And we spend so little time paying attention to our own minds that we get lost in the objects of our desire, as is said. And you can spend, as Mark says, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, or you can spend all day at it. And a large number of the experiences that are supposed to be the great experiences of yogic life and so on are really just different forms of being aware of your own mind inside yourself. And the interpretation of those is given in advance. I mean, you can say, for example, a good example of that actually is, you know, I'll use one from your speech and one from my childhood. You know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and in the lead up to communion is just tremendous. And so you're just all ready for this experience, and you're going to experience it. There's a physical thing to it, but you're going to experience it the way you have been trained to emotionally experience it. Same thing is true about now something very mundane in another sense, is the workout. You talked about how the workout is this wonderful thing. This is, you know, obviously your body creates a certain amount of chemical reaction to it, but it's your emotional setup for the workout that makes the workout this emotional experience, spiritual experience. If you don't have that setup, it's just a workout. And so the mind and attitudes toward it, that's what's doing almost all the work for all the things that go on in life. And what for me, because I also, Mark and I have discussed this before, in my youth I also taught meditation for a while. And I found it fascinating that the most divine experiences that were described were actually just the surprise that I have a mind.
I just want to comment and say that I think contemplative prayer does the same thing that you're talking about with meditation.
Well, I'm sure it does.
And it would be a Christian meditation rather than the Eastern techniques.
Yeah. I mean, as I answered his question, I don't think there's one way to meditate. I think the important thing, though, is to meditate. And I've actually, like say, given some talks about meditation, and people get hung up on the technique rather than doing it. And I think the important, and again, I'm into evolving, and what I do now, sometimes in my meditation, I play my bamboo flute. And that helps me get into that deeper state, into that stillness, into that calm, that just gives me that perspective, that center, so I can, I don't get caught up in the emotion of the day.
Some people love power napping. Yeah. Basically, it's getting back into your own mind. But let's have some more questions. Anybody else? Time for about 2 more questions.
What were the circumstances that led up to your leaving the law?
Well, I, you know, I think I felt that I've always been into meditation. As I said, this is my 40th year of meditation. I'm also a musician, and I've you know, been into spiritual things. I've been a seeker, and I knew there was something else for me to do. And financially, I was very successful in the 90s with my law practice and the investments we made. And I really knew there was something else out there for me. And so I went to a career counselor. And when I talked to the career counselor, nothing came of it. I went there, and this is 99. But it was the idea, with the new millennium coming, there was so much momentum. And I heard that we're entering the age of Aquarius or the world's going to come to an end, just like they continue this rapture, which whatever the rapture, and then it's 2000, and there's always this doomsday scenario. The year 2000 was huge with this doomsday scenario. And I said, I'm not going there. I'm going in the age of Aquarius. And part of my vision was, I just knew. But then when I went to the career counselor, my assumption, this is why sometimes we have assumptions and we have to be willing to let them go. My assumption was that I would have another career to go into. And so when I stopped being a lawyer, I'd have another career to go into. Went to the career counselor. Nothing came of it. I started to question whether I should go ahead to do it because I'd given up a very successful business. So I was talking to one of my close friends, Franklin, and Franklin said to me, why do you need another career? You had a career as a lawyer for 30 years. And I started to think about it, and I realized he was right. I could take a year off. Annie and I talked about 1 year off, like some families let go, and the whole family travels for a year. What would it be like if I took a year off? And I didn't know what I was going to do. I did not have any idea of going to coaching. So I took a year off, and then I had a lot of despair, right? I mean, because I know people that have given up careers, and they start to second guess it. So I had a lot of despair, And I would go to this place called Optimum Health, which was in Austin. And there was a man there who used to be a Presbyterian minister, Russell Neese. And I talked to him, and I said, Russell, you know, I have a lot of despair. I know I have a calling, and I don't know what that is. And he said, well, thanks, Spirit, for revealing that to you, and it'll be revealed. And 6 months later, it became clear that I needed to do this work that I'm doing now. And I called a coaching school, and we were in Hawaii then, signed up for their course. On the plane home, there was a man who said to me, I know you. You're a lawyer and a musician. And I go, I haven't practiced law for a year. He goes, what are you going to do? And I said, I think I'm going to become a life coach. He said, if you do, call me. And he's been my client ever since. And a very close friend. He's a musician. We've celebrated holidays together. And that was a message from the universe that I made the right decision. So it was a leap of faith. Sometimes you got to take that leap of faith and just go for it. And I was willing to do it. And I've always kind of been that way. I've always been a, you know, I would say probably I'm a risk taker and putting myself out there and maybe making a fool of myself. I'm always the first, I don't have any hesitancy about telling a joke. But it was that idea that I had a calling. And unless I took that step, I would never know what it is. And I would have regrets about that, just like the Mark Twain quote. You know, 20 years from now, you'd have more regrets by the things you didn't do than the things you did. And I felt that way. And I said, you know what? I'm only around here once. I got to go for it.
Speaking of once, there's one more question.
You also speak about being a life coach. Do you have a training that you had to get or a degree?
Well, I trained at a coaching school, but the work I do now is what I've developed personally and the people that I work with individually. I have my own methodology and the way I do it, my own belief system. So that's what I integrate in the people I work with. But there are many, many coaching schools, and they all have a slight twist in terms of what they think you should do. But I've, you know, I was a lawyer before I did this. I've been into meditation. And so I said, you know what, these are the principles I've come up with, and this is how I do it.
Thanks once again to Mark Sussman.
Thank you for having me.